All right, everyone, here we go again. Welcome back to the best weekly true crime podcast on the market, The Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. And welcome to episode 145 with another fantastic guest. I'll tell you more about him in a few minutes. But you know what? If you listened to last week's episode, you probably know who we're here from today. If you didn't listen to last week's episode, why not? You're slipping and falling behind here. Come on, catch up. You know, first, let's get some housekeeping out of the way. Head over to Apple or Spotify and hit those 5 stars. It might not sound like much to you, but you know what? It really helps us out with the ratings. I appreciate if you do that. Continue to send me your comments and feedback. I love hearing what you think about everything. And I want to say special thanks to those of you who have taken the time to let me know what you think about the shows, the guests, and slowly improving my editing skills. I'm slowly getting there. Also, check out our website at gameofcrimespodcast.com. If you haven't visited the site yet, this is where you'll find all of our episodes, our book list, some merchandise, and more. You know what? As an update, Connie is creating some new items for the merchandise list. She's working on new designs, new logos, new artwork. There's going to be a larger selection to choose from than there was before, so stay tuned for more info on that. We're hoping to roll that out a few items at a time. I'll keep you posted once we get it up and running. It should be very soon. If you're into social media on Facebook and Instagram, you can go to Game of Crimes Podcast. And if you like X, formerly known as Twitter, you can just go to Game of Crimes. So on Facebook and Instagram, it's Game of Crimes Podcast. On X, it's Game of Crimes. But while you're on Facebook, check out the Game of Crimes Fan Club. Now, that's run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato. Show her respect. She's the lady that rules with the iron fist, but she wears a velvet glove, so it's not going to hurt too bad if she smacks you. You know, it's not all about the podcast either. There's a lot of posts and comments there. It's a great place to go if you just want to have a little bit of fun, so go and check it out. If you want even more content, check us out on patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Now, again, a heads up, Patreon is still on hold for a couple more weeks, and my plan is to restart the Patreon channel on June 1st, so stay tuned for more on that. That's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. And one final site I want to tell you about. Many of you already know that my old DEA partner, Javier Pena, and I travel around the world as keynote speakers. This is our 9th year, believe it or not. And this is where we tell the true story about Pablo Escobar and the Medellin cartel. We have a lot of fun doing that. If you're curious about what that is and you want to check us out, you can go to our website. That's DEANarcos.com. DEANarcos.com. There we've got a lot of information, pictures, calendar, merchandise. There's a few other things on there. Basically, you can go there and see how great we think we are, okay? Quick disclaimer, this is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. I do take the story seriously, but we're also going to have some fun here, so it never hurts to laugh at yourself, right? And since we're not being serious and we're ready to laugh about some things, it's time for one of my favorite sections, a section dedicated to stupid criminal stories. You know what time it is. It's time for Small Town Police Spotter. Woohoo! Okay, first story up. A New Jersey business owner wore a jacket bearing his name and phone number when he stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Robert Capitelli, 27 years old, was arrested Wednesday and charged with 4 misdemeanor counts of unlawfully entering the Capitol with the goal of disrupting the session of Congress. Although Capitelli's face was fairly disguised by a mask and a hat, the business owner's name was clearly visible on his left breast and plastered across his back. This is so funny, I can't even get through it. The business owner allegedly spent 12 minutes walking through the stormed building before crawling through a broken window and vanishing. Investigators easily tracked down Capitelli's business, which is registered with the U.S. Department of Transportation at the same Toms River address where Capitelli just happens to live. Notably, the company's logo matched the text and artwork, which contained a large American flag shown on the suspect's jacket. This is the best part. Capitelli could not be immediately reached for comment. Well, I don't think I'd want to comment about that either. How much stupider can you get? Next story. In Long Island, a scientist copped to running a Breaking Bad-style meth lab that initially landed on police radar when he called about a break-in at the facility last year. Matthew Leshinsky accidentally called the cops on himself when he dialed 911 around 3:30 a.m. on June 7th to report a burglary in progress at his purported establishment known as Quantitative Laboratories. When Suffolk County police got there and searched the scene, officers found broken glass at the entrance to the lab, a facility which they eventually realized was secretly manufacturing and pumping out methamphetamine and other controlled substances. More than 100 items of lab equipment, chemical reagents, and solvents that go into meth were found. along with over 3 ounces of meth, 625,000 milligrams of pure ketamine, and 20 plastic jugs containing GBL, which is similar to the date rape drug known as GHB, which, if you don't know, is concrete cleaner. There's something you want to put in your system, isn't it? The cops also found about $40,000 there. Now, Leshinsky says on his LinkedIn page that his laboratory analyzes cannabis, but strangely, they found no cannabis there. Though he admitted to manufacturing the potent and deadly drugs, his lawyer attempted to paint a positive picture of his client. Because, of course he did. It's smoke and mirrors. My client is a brilliant scientist who's examining drug addiction for the public good and denied he sold meth out of the lab. What do we call that? We call that bullshit. The Farmington resident overall pleaded to 13 charges tied to the case, including multiple counts of criminal possession of a controlled substance and an unlawful manufacture of meth. All right, ladies and gentlemen, what's the number one rule in a game of crimes? Don't do meth. I guess he hasn't listened to our show. And our last story, a fugitive wanted for fraud was busted when she walked into a New Jersey sheriff's office and asked to be hired. Zima Johnson, 27 years old, a former postal service worker from Jersey City, was on the run for the crime in Monroe County, Pennsylvania, when she applied to work at the Hudson County Sheriff's Office. She sent in paperwork to be a security guard at the law enforcement agency. So what they did is they called her in the station under the guise of a job interview, and guess what happened? She got arrested. After the alleged foolhardy fraudster was busted, the officers allegedly discovered 2 stolen credit cards, and she was also hit with credit card theft charges. And prior to applying for a job, she was also wanted on 10 bench warrants for failure to appear in court on traffic charges in Jersey City. And what do we call that? We call that a freaking idiot. Okay, hope you enjoyed those stories there. Now for today's guest. I mentioned last week's episode, that was with Jenna Griffith, and that was fantastic. I mean, I've gotten a lot of positive comments from our listeners out there. Well, this week's guest is Seth Griffith, her husband. Now, this is the first time Game of Crimes has had back-to-back episodes with a wife and husband team. And I got to tell you, both of these people are heroes in every sense of the word. These two are the proverbial dynamic duo. I haven't seen it with my own eyes, but I'm pretty sure they could probably leap tall buildings in a single bound if you were ever a Superman fan. Jen and Seth both set the standard for others to follow, and in my humble opinion, they represent what's good in our world. Okay, time for me to shut up so we can get on with today's guest. So now, if you're ready, you know what you got to do. You got to get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. Here we go with the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. I'm so excited to be back with our guest today. And if you recall last week's episode, we had a young lady on here, Jenna Griffith. You heard her story. If you haven't, you got to go back and listen to it. It's one of the best ones we've had so far. That lady, what she's been through, and to suck it up and not sit back and feel sorry for herself. She's making the best out of life that she can, and it's gotten to the point where she's dramatically helping other people that I call the unsung heroes, and that's the families of our military veterans and our first responders who we expect to sit home and take care of business. You know, Connie was the same way. She had to take care of the girls. She had to take care of the house. She had to take care of maintenance on the cars. When the power went out or the plumbing was screwed up or whatever it might be, she just took it on to keep that off of my plate because, you know, I was out doing what I thought was God's work. I still think it was God's work. But the reality is I was out having fun because it was exciting. It was dangerous. And I loved what I did. And so what happens is us heroes, we think we're heroes, superheroes. We get all the credit for everything. And our families are just sitting back left to kind of hold the bag, and it's just not fair. And so when I speak to audiences now, especially if it's a fundraiser or it's a gala affair or whatever it might be, such as a military appreciation weekend in Beaufort, South Carolina a couple months ago, I always bring up the unsung heroes. I make that part of my little talk. They deserve the credit. They deserve the recognition. Last year, I was the keynote speaker at the Orlando Police Foundation, their Blue Line Gala for the year, their big fundraiser. And I recognize the cops, you know, past and present. I have them stand up, let everybody see them. But then I always recognize the unsung heroes, and I ask the families to stand up. And when I do that, you wouldn't believe the appreciation and the applause that they get. And when you talk to them afterwards, they all thank you for recognizing them. And they say that's never been done before. So, you know what, by crackies, we're going to do it here on Game of Crimes. We're going to recognize our unsung heroes. And Jen is a leader in that realm. Well, now, if you did listen to her episode, you probably got a good idea who today's guest is because we talked about it. We have today a gentleman by the name of Seth Griffith, and that just happens to be Jenna's husband. If you heard, and just in case you didn't hear last week's story, I met Jen and Seth in South Carolina a couple months ago at the Corps Medical Group 3rd Annual Military Appreciation Weekend. And if you have heard me talk about it, I was in awe of these people. I mean, you talk about a tent full of studs and studettes. It was just, I've never seen that many service dogs in my life. It was amazing, the people there, their attitudes, their personalities, what they've done in life is things that they make movies out of. People that, like you and me, probably never get to meet most of these folks. I got to do a keynote address. I can stand in front of thousands of people and not be nervous at all. But in front of these people, I felt like I was out of place. I was in such awe of these people. I can't think of a better word to explain it because of what they'd done. So when I met Jenna, she was the first speaker and I heard what she was doing. I thought, man, I really like that. And I mentioned her when I got up and did my little keynote, and she came up afterwards and thanked me. And this big burly guy with this big, he's got more hair on his face than I got, I think, on my entire body. He's got one of these beards that just, it looks like you could probably shave his beard off and I could make a toupee out of this guy's beard. And see, we're doing this interview remote, so he can't reach through the screen and kick my ass right now. Because I might get slapped for some things I just said to you. But brother Seth Griffith, welcome to Game of Crimes. I can't tell you what an honor it is to have you on here, brother.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. And did a good job of explaining the Corps Medical event, and I've definitely outkicked my coverage with Jenna. I definitely had to go through some trials and tribulations to end up meeting my purpose partner, and I met her, and we were hoping to impact a lot. We're already impacting lives. We're going to impact a lot more.
That's outstanding. And for our listeners here, you may hear there's a little, I'm going to try to take these gaps out. But Seth, when we were talking just before we started recording this, we discussed this gap, but he brought something to my attention that I hadn't heard of, consideration for a pause before you speak. Can you tell us just very quickly, Seth, a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's very powerful if you can practice a pause, a 2.5 second pause, personal interaction, stressor, just practice that pause, if anything, to collect yourself and to make sure that you're listening and you're not responding, listening to respond. Like I said before, be quick to listen and slower to speak so that people are heard. And I'm speaking to myself, and I say that to you. A lot of guys need to hear this.
Yeah. Well, I know you've listened to part of Jenna's interview. Our listeners will tell you I'm pretty quick to speak. I engage my mouth before I engage my brain a lot of times. And a lot of times I'm sorry for what comes out of it. But I just want our listeners to be aware of that. So this is not me screwing up the techniques, although I might do it anyway. But I love the fact that ladies and gentlemen, this is a true American hero. This is a patriot we're talking to today. This is not somebody that just, couldn't find a job anywhere else and decided to come on the show and make something. This is a guy who's been there and done that. Wait till we get into all the things he's done and what he's doing now. And I think you'll agree with me 100% here. But the fact that you brought that to my attention, I'm sure when Connie listens to this, you'll probably say, hey, you could learn something from Seth there. Shut your mouth for a little bit. She's a tough girl. She cuts me no slack. Seth, just to get us started here, tell us where you grew up and if you got brothers and sisters and where you went to high school. Did you play sports in high school? That kind of thing.
Yeah, crazy story. It gets a little crazier towards the end. Anyways, I'll just jump into it. So grew up in St. Louis suburbs. Typical family. Dad was, my stepdad that raised me was retired Air Force. And, so he was pretty strict and ran a pretty tight ship, if you will. Did play sports, was pretty athletically gifted. I forget, what year it was, but there was one summer where I think it was like between like fifth and sixth grade where just all of a sudden I just could like run faster and could do everything. Things came natural to me, like tactile things. I was able to be good at doing stuff, mm-hmm. whether it be sports or riding motocross or, what have you. If I wanted to do it, I could pretty much just kind of pick it up and just do it. So grew up in St. Louis suburbs. I have a younger brother, Josh, half brother that I grew up with, and he and I are so different. I can probably just leave it at that. It's a super, super long story that I have enough time for, but not super close. I have two other brothers that, and this is where it kind of gets crazy, Alex and Perry, that are my half brothers. So my name on my birth certificate was Seth Akiva Kranzberg, and okay. I was adopted by my stepfather, and I became Seth Herbert Griffith. And, you know, I'm going to try to keep this straight because it's kind of an interesting story when we start talking about some of the missions, specifically Ukraine, down the road. But I always knew that, you know, my biological birth father was Jewish, and I knew his name was Sheldon, lived in the Kansas City, Missouri area. So I reached out on Facebook to, I found an Alex on there, Alex Kranzberg. I said, hey, do you know my dad? I'm looking for a Sheldon Kranzberg. And he's like, yes, I know him. He's my father. How do you know him? So that was kind of interesting. And then he actually went to his mom and Sheldon, our dad, divorced years ago. Sheldon just wasn't meant to be a father. This is not in his DNA. So he went to his mom and said, hey, so this guy Seth reached out to me, and his mom wasn't shocked at all and was kind of like, yeah. And I can't remember the exact exchange, but she said, basically, hold on, went into like whatever, you know, she had or safe or whatnot. And she had this paperwork still from like years ago from the courts in St. Louis for paternity testing. Cause I was going to be I would have been, I think, the firstborn grandson. And, you know, it turns out that, you remember when you would run checks through back in the day at the store and it would run it through the thing, it would go loop in and loop back out and it would imprint something on it. Turns out my grandfather invented that thing. And my dad, Sheldon, did sales all around the country doing that. So he's just, you know, like I said, just wasn't wasn't just built to be a father, or, you know, mentor in that way. So Alex reached out to Sheldon, you know, our dad, and said, hey, the Seth guy reached out to me. Sheldon's super upset. You know, he was like, wait, we don't know what's going on, blah, blah, blah. His mom didn't show up to the paternity testing. My mom was afraid that they were going to try to take me, you know, because they had all this money. My mom really, you know, she's, you know, struggling. She just graduated high school and wasn't the same position they were in. So we did this DNA testing. And if you have the same, if you're siblings with the same father, but different mothers, there are 16 male chromosomes that'll be identical. Okay. And, you know, we did the saliva and I forget what else we did. And we sent it off and it took weeks. It was like, I felt like I was like, you know, getting ready to be on the Jerry Springer show. And, you know, the results come back in. I don't know if you've probably looked at DNA before or seen it at some level and some kind of evidence or something. It's, you know, it's these lines and it's all this stuff in there. And then I'm kind of trying to decipher it. And I always know, like, just from my military background, like the legends at the bottom, right? The legend for the map, you know, whatever. But find what's explaining what this is. There's going to be some notes in there. And I go to the very bottom and I you know, right there it is. We, you know, we shared those 16 genes, the same or chromosomes. So I called up Alex. So I think I got mine first. And I was like, hey, what's going on, brother? So we just got confirmation. And then I was getting ready to deploy to Afghanistan for one of my several deployments. I was on the ride mower, you know, it was like just kind of a mindless thing. Just go out there, put a podcast in or whatnot and just cut the, you know, mow the grass. And I got a call from a Kansas City number that wasn't Alex and it wasn't Perry, you know, my other brother there. And it was my first conversation I had with Sheldon.
Wow.
Like ever. And I'm 35 years old. Now, fast forward. And that was when I was still active duty. That was 2008, I think.
Wow.
A lot of deployments. So you fast forward. I you know, retired from the military in 2015. And we'll circle back to that here in a minute. Don't let me forget to go back to that. And I'm in, I think we were in Poland, and this was, you know, when the Russian aggression started happening there and their special military operation. In Ukraine, one of the people we're traveling with, I forget how it got out, but my brother Alex somehow picked up I was in Poland. And he goes, basically, are you going, you know, where we think you're going? And we're like, I was like, you kind of cryptic a little bit, but like, yes. And he says, like, holy cow. So he's like, can you talk for a few minutes? And we were getting ready to go comms black because we got close to the, not to give away, you know, any of our techniques, but, you know, we were using, you know, different, you know, SIM cards to the Ukrainian. So we weren't putting out any kind of U.S., you know, signal out there, and we're using ARF. Anyways, before I went into that comm status, I called him, and he said, hey, just so you know, all I knew is our family, they fled. The Kranzberg family came to the United States through Poland, to the U.K., to New York City, Chicago, and then St. Louis is where Sheldon met my mom. All I knew is they were Western Russian Jews. Turns out they were Ukrainian from Kyiv, where wow. I was getting ready to millions of people leaving Ukraine, and I'm walking, you know, one of the people walking into Ukraine with a big rucksack on and some Pelican cases and just kind of head down low, just kind of trying to hide in plain sight, just not draw any attention. That's going through my head like, wow, like this is kind of crazy. Like, how to write that story.
I'm sitting here with my chin on the table, just in awe of what you're telling me here. Your story about finding your dad. I have a very good friend who's a retired police officer in North Carolina. A lot of our listeners, law enforcement listeners, know him. His name's Kevin Black. Very well known. He's like you. He's a stud. Got muscles on top of his muscles. One of the funniest people you'll ever meet. I met him he was with the sheriff's department there in North Carolina when I was stationed there back in the mid-90s. And we had Kevin on as a show. He was episode 86 that came out on February 20th, 2023. And he's got some hilarious stories. He talks about shitting in his pants and things like that. But you got to come back and listen if you never heard it. In the story, and I had already found this out because Kevin and I stay in touch over the years, he did one of the 23andMe tests or whatever those tests are, and identified he was adopted, and he found his birth mom and dad, and they were like the next county over. And Kevin is at retirement age when he finds them. And he makes no bones about it. His adoptive parents, or that's the parents that raised him. But he went and made contact with his biological parents and now he's got two families, and it just, it's one of those stories that'll bring a tear to your eye. And I think even Kevin got a little bit emotional talking about it, because, I mean, that's, what he's talking about. That's huge that you found your biological dad. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. If I sent him a message, Jenna said I slid into her DMs, meeting her, but I did send Alex a message on Facebook, just basically saying, hey, you know, a Sheldon Kransberg?
Outstanding.
Crazy.
Yeah. I feel like this. I don't believe in coincidence. I don't believe in luck. I believe things happen for a reason. I think the good man upstairs has things planned out for us. But what an adventure. Just that in itself is a story. Holy cow. You guys, these things, the guests that we have on here, you guys should all be writing books about all your experiences, because, I did one thing and a book came out of it, a TV show. You guys have multiple experiences that just, I know people would sit back. That's what I think makes Game of Crime so popular, is we're bringing folks on like you, Seth, that are just doing things that other people have no clue about. And we're just scratching the surface here. So now, when you were in high school, did you were into athletics as you were growing up. Did you play any organized sports in high school?
Yeah, I played football. I played basketball. I played baseball. One year I played baseball and ran track, and it's the same. See, that was hard. I just tried to stay out of the house. I was pretty social. Sports came easy to me. It was just more of me like trying to hone things rather than digest, a playbook or perfect a throw, whatever it is, or, tactile thing. And it was, we grew up, water skiing and jet skiing. I remember my stepdad throwing me out of the boat when I was probably six, maybe younger than that. We were in a lake in Oklahoma, and he just basically you're gonna learn how to swim today. And I'm like, yeah, that sounds fun. I didn't realize he's gonna throw me in a lake.
Oh, shit.
And it was as muddy. What lake was that? It was Lake Draper, or Lake Thunderbird. It was outside of Oklahoma City, and it was like this muddy. You can't see anything. It's like swimming in like chocolate milk almost. But
what did you swim?
I swam. I did not sink. I swam. Turns out I was a pretty decent swimmer.
We all kid about doing that with our kids, but occasionally it really happens, huh?
Yeah, but no. In high school, I was very. I actually started learning some lessons in high school, and I hadn't really put a whole lot of stock into that until I kind of started just, when you reflect on things, just the crowd, I was liked by everyone. I hung out with most of the guys from athletics, from sports and stuff like that. But like, I was everyone's friend. And when I was younger, like junior high, I actually got in a little bit of trouble and for fighting and stuff like that. And my parents put me in Catholic school for almost 4 years at SPPS, St. Peter and Paul School. And that didn't help with that. It just was, just really, really strict. When I got into high school, I saw a really bad bullying incident from a buddy of mine had done. And that just, it really just kind of shook me. And it was beginning of my sophomore year of high school. And that was basically when I kind of started taking up sticking up for people. And that's when I really had a heart for fighting for people that need help. And my little brother, Josh, he struggled. He was low birth weight and he's on the shorter end of the spectrum, just wasn't athletic and just things didn't come easy to him. And I stuck up for him a lot. And I, you know, harbored a lot of feelings for me thriving and him not, and, you know, kind of going through that as a teenager and, you know, your mom struggling with those kind of things as well. But I've always just rooted for the underdog. I've always wanted to see, like, I want everyone to eat. I want everyone to eat dinner. I may not want everyone eating at my dinner table with me, but I want everyone to eat.
Right. Everyone. That's a great sentiment. I'm with you. Connie fusses at me a little bit sometimes because, you know, the good Lord has blessed us with enough financial funds to contribute to certain groups. And the bad side is once you contribute to one, they sell your name and then, you know, you'll get like 1,000 solicits. The only mail I get is either bills or organizations want me to donate to them now. But the organizations that we always stick with, and there's three every month that we donate to, are all food banks. Because I agree, nobody should go hungry in our country. This is the freaking United States. You know, nobody should be going hungry in our country.
And you've been to a lot of countries. I know. I've been to all over 80 plus countries, and the hunger, some of the problems in some of these parts of the world, people, it's very easy to have a very American lens on things. Mm-hmm. Especially if you grew up, and it's not some people's fault that they didn't travel when they were growing up. I didn't travel. You know, us traveling was going to Texas and hanging out for 3 or 4 days and, you know, jet skiing and, you know, water skiing and kneeboarding on a lake with our cousins and stuff like that. We didn't go to like Europe or didn't go to South America. I didn't get exposed to that. And to some of like just how real and sad certain things are in the world until I joined the military.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of that out there. I mean, you know, there's a lot of places that they just don't have the same position that we have. So like I said, it's easy to have that American lens on things.
Yeah. And some of our listeners have heard me say this before. If I was a dictator of the United States for a day, I would require every American to go live in a third world country for at least a year and then come back and tell me how bad we are. I lived in Colombia for 3 years. Yeah. It's a beautiful country. It's not so, it's a little bit third world, but it's more progressive than most third world countries. It's just beautiful. It's my favorite country in the world after the United States. But later in my career, the administrator of DEA offered me to go back as the boss of Colombia and a couple other countries down there, South America. And it was a big deal. But I told her, I said, you know what living overseas did for me? It made me appreciate living in the United States. So thank you, but no thank you. It's crazy. And that's Murph getting off on a tangent there.
Are you talking, speaking about tangents, and since you brought up Murph, I got to ask, I keep looking at the Narcos in the background. Did you get any say in who they cast for your character in the series on Netflix?
None whatsoever. You know, it's funny because they would send us, they would go to these casting companies and I mean, they were sending us. So Jake Gyllenhaal, they're looking at Jake Gyllenhaal, or they're looking at Armie Hammer. Most of these people I didn't know because I'm not real big into TV and movies. But some of them, you look at their picture and like, oh, yeah, I've seen this guy a lot. And I think they just did it so we wouldn't call him. But they ended up hiring a guy named Boyd Holbrook, who is, I think, did a fantastic job. He and I have stayed friends. We stay in touch. In fact, he's going to do a little thing for me here. We had him on as a guest here on Game of Crimes, and he's going to do a little intro for me here in the not-too-distant future, I'm thinking. So, but what'd you think of him?
You know, I've worked with a lot of agency guys, you know, when we were active duty doing that kind of stuff and this, that, and the other. I think they did a good job. There's some that some guys have, you know, a little John Wayne in them. And obviously you gotta sex it up. Every explosion has to be a fireball. They'd never listen to a military advisor on the set because they're like, look, the investors, we got to make money because they invested all this. We got to make everything explosion super gnarly. We're like, okay. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think they did a good job. It's funny. I'm a narration guy. I like the story. I really enjoyed the show, not for any reason. This sounds weird, but I really enjoyed Dexter because the narration.
Yeah. All right.
Series about a guy that worked at Miami-Dade in forensics. And but he was a serial killer that only killed like bad people.
Well, yeah. Well, is that a bad thing? I don't know. We have to think about that. Okay, let's move on. You know, the funny thing about Boyd.
He kind of took justice into his own hands.
Yep. When we did Boyd's interview towards the end, he said, hey, I just want to tell you guys something that, and I never knew this. Every day he would shave his hairline to give him a receding hairline. I'm like, dude, you could have gone the rest of my life without telling me that. I don't need to know that. I mean, what a guy, man. He was fantastic. You know, and the other thing is we learned in dealing with Netflix and they were very good to us. I'm not complaining about them. But what we found out is Hollywood will never let the truth get in the way of telling a good story now, will they?
Yeah, we can talk for so many, about so many examples of, you know, movies or shows and people, what really from people that were really there and what happened. And you got to put butts in seats. And the only way you put butts in seats is to make it super sexy. Fight scenes and fireballs and all that stuff.
Well, neither one of, you know, the thing I don't understand, and they did this in Griselda, the 4-6-part series that just came out. That was the same executive producer that did Narcos, Eric Newman, and it was on Netflix also. And every scene, the first thing that either Javier and I do or the cops do in Griselda is light a cigarette. Neither one of us smoked. We smoked cigars occasionally. We didn't smoke cigarettes. I guess that's supposed to be the sexy thing in Hollywood, you know?
Everyone is that they're trying to make it be like it was like, you know, that time frame.
Man, it's crazy. All right, let's get back to you here. When you were in high school, how were your grades and did you have any plans? Were you going to go to college? What were your plans to do after high school?
You know, my plans, I really didn't have much of a plan. I always thought I would be an athlete. Didn't work out, you know, got in some trouble. My grades, not bad trouble, just, you know, silly trouble. My grades were, I was a pretty much like a C student, and that's because I did not do homework. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was just, again, it was, I could just sit in the class, half pay attention when I knew when I needed to focus and knew when I could just take a nap and drool for a second or, you know, do whatever, go to Walmart and start daydreaming about something. But I was always a good test taker. In the military, you know, you test for promotion in the Air Force. You know, I've always been good at taking tests. If you just kind of look at it and do some problem solving and process elimination and pay attention to words or whatever, there's some psychology behind tests. And I helped put some of that stuff in the military with developing part of a career field for a new officer career fields. Some of it made sense. I was like, I didn't realize I was doing those things. I was doing quite a few of these principles about not changing answers and, you know, mm-hmm. Too long to be wrong sometimes on an answer when there's a lot of information. You're like, yeah, that all makes sense. Like, yeah, they're doing that to kind of trick you up sometimes, like psychologically with that test. But, was just liked by my teachers. So that bought me some grace. My daughter picked up that habit and we noticed that with her going through high school that she kind of used it to, you know, to kind of manipulate it a little bit. Maybe I did too, but it was just, you know, was well liked. But I've always been well liked by, you know, the staff, the faculty, the whoever, the, you know, people at church, whatever. Just I try to be very outgoing. I try to be genuine and real. And some people may not be okay with that and may not understand that. But, you know, we just live in a world that, I don't know. I think you just watching the dynamics of my parents' marriage at a young age, I realized like that there's what people see, right? There could be the facade and then there can also be like the reality, you know, the truth somewhere in the middle. But I just kind of learned how to navigate through the dynamics of that home life with my, you know, my father. He was an Air Force veteran and he has a lot of pain from his service. Just, he was taking pain pills a lot and there's a lot of them arguing. So I just learned to navigate through and kind of hide in plain sight, if you will, you know, at a young age, basically just kind of blending in, but never really applied myself like with my academics, was able to just go in and get a high B on a test and keep that, you know, strong C average and not, you know, get any kind of academic situation where I might, you know, not get to play in athletics, basically.
Yeah, I got to tell you, when we first met, I was more talking to Jenna because she had done the talk and she was talking about the unsung heroes. We kind of had that in common. And she introduced me to you, and I think you were being respectful.
There at the
you seemed
hotel, right?
Quiet at the time. Pardon?
Yeah, it was at the hotel lobby, I think, and it was the evening at like 10 o'clock at night, right? Something like that.
Yeah, it was late. That's like way past my bedtime. Just so you
I
know.
Believe you all were sitting there at the benches, you yep. and some of your friends, right there. I think it was the first time. I think it was, and it was. I was also just being around a lot of people. And granted, even though it was a bunch of veterans, I mean, did you feel, when was the last time you felt that safe?
Probably when I go to the DEA Academy and speak there.
Yeah.
Which was, I mean, just like a month ago.
Yeah. And so just some of my struggles, you know, is I stay so turned on and I'm putting on the, you know, I'm doing business development or I'm, just to kind of like doing how I navigate atmospherics and situations. It's like at the end of the day, I'm like just kind of talked out sometimes, mm-hmm. a lot of times. And also, you know, I get such a bad relationship. That's beautiful. I don't know if y'all can see. That's Jenna. I outkick my coverage. Seriously. I don't know, Steve, what I did to deserve this. Doing better than I deserve. That's for sure, brother.
You know what happened. A good man upstairs took care of
being, you know, being in certain situations, it will drain me. Yeah. Yeah. Like not that I'm hyper vigilant, but just, you know, just certain things just kind of change you and just change the way when I came in and started peeling back some of the layers and some of the problems in the world that we talked about here in a little bit with area recovery. You know, once you start seeing some of these things, you know, you've seen them. So you start looking at the world way different. You start looking at the person across at a restaurant, maybe a little differently, just based off some indicators or something that may be a trigger that you may notice is like kind of like not a normal pattern of life, or just, you know, you just can't turn that part of you off. Yeah. I was probably a little quiet, a little ready just to go, like, you know, chill out. And we also keep a very high operational tempo at Aerial Recovery. We train a lot. We engage with our donors and supporters. We deploy for disaster responses all over the planet. You know, we combat human trafficking. We stay fit. You know, we have a hard time sitting still. We try sitting on our hands, but they'll just fail.
Yeah.
Hard to sit still. Yeah. I was just talking about this, about, you know, trying to pour from an empty cup, you know, because if you don't pour back into yourself, you know, you're not going to have anything to pour out and to help other people. And you almost get to where when you're running a high pace, when you try to sit still, you kind of like trying to get your sea legs back. Mm-hmm. You know, trying to get your land legs back when you get off a boat. I don't know. Sometimes I find, I don't know if it's the same with you, but I have a hard time sitting still, or it's, you know, if like, so Jenna's gone at a thing with Women Connect. She does so many things. And, you know, after our podcast, I'll probably hang out with Zachary. I mean, I could go down. I've got a lot of friends, you know, that I could go see some really cool live music in Nashville. Come to town. We'll go see some fun stuff. And we won't have to go to Broadway to do either, Steve. But I almost forgot, like, how to hang out, because I don't go out and like really drink anymore. I can have a couple drinks, but as part of my military story, military is a big culture. They're big drinking, culture of drinking.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, it really is. And it's the same in the law enforcement field. It's, what I tell people is what cops like to do is drink beer and tell war stories. And, you know, and in retirement, you live vicariously through what everybody else does. And I don't drink alcohol anymore. So I tell a lot of war stories. That's called a speaking business. But so, you're graduating high school, was military on your radar, or did your dad suggest that, or how'd you get interested in special?
He actually did. Yeah. He actually did. And he told me about the Air Force. The Air Force had, interesting. There's some special operations jobs in the Air Force that people really don't know about, or jobs where you do, not your typical Air Force type thing. And I chose that path. Because you to go in and be at a Green Beret, I had to go in, you know, they didn't have an X-ray program when I was enlisting, which was where, you know, you could go straight into special forces. You know, you had to go and, you know, be an infantryman first. And that's not a ding on infantryman. I was just kind of like, I want to do it now. And I was impatient. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, high performer. I don't need to wait for that. I'm ready for it now. And the Air Force gave me that, the track to do that with becoming a TACP and, you know, getting JTAC qualified and deploying a lot and, doing some good things and being gone a lot, sometimes knowing, you know, when I would be back in Afghanistan again, before I even left Afghanistan to go home, I would knew like where I'd be back and where I'd be. So I start doing some intel on like that battle space, like, oh, I'm going to be two villages over next time or whatever it is. And I start just kind of doing a little, you know, just on the Google machine and getting familiar with whatever. Just, all right. You didn't shut off. It was a machine there for a while. And we were doing Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, how old were you when you went in the Air Force?
19. I had just turned 19.
And where do you go to boot camp in the Air Force?
Lackland Air Force Base.
Was it?
Lackland Air Force Base. Sorry?
Was it a lot of fun?
Yeah. Oddly enough, you know, I was just preparing. I graduated, I still kept like running and working out with my cousin and everything. And just, when I realized I was going to join the military, I was like, all right, let me step it up. I actually got in worse shape in basic training.
Wow, really?
It was opposite for me. I felt like we were eating all the time. I was eating sometimes when I wasn't hungry. You know, we would run. I mean, I think, and granted, this isn't a ding on Air Force people, but I want to say like maybe the first week you ran for 10 minutes and they like blew a whistle and you ran back or whatever it was, or I forget. But it wasn't very hard. It was very much a build you up And I was used to, you know, going on a 5-6 mile run. I was used to, you know, going and crushing a bunch of pull-ups or practicing doing flutter kicks or, you know, this, that, and the other, doing very functional things. I actually just, you know, my physical conditioning actually got, you know, it lessened while I was in basic training. And then, you know, you start the real stuff after basic. Air Force basic training is, it's hard in some ways because they just throw a bunch of information. They're like one to check your intellect and like gauge you in different areas. You know, obviously the Marine Corps boot camp is designed differently because the Marine Corps mission is different, just like the Army and the Navy. But, you know, the thing about the tech peaker field in the Air Force is you're in the Air Force, but you're stationed on Army posts. You're going to Army schools. You're, mm-hmm. you know, you're living there with the guys. You know, but you're still the one Air Force guy. You know? So I always had to try to out Army the Army or try to out Navy the Navy, you know, because, you know, I was Griff. I was the close air support guy. I was the guy that was there to, you know, break in case of emergency if you need to get out of a bad situation or sometimes. But again, that was building me learning how to navigate different dynamics, different atmospherics. Each team is different. It's different working with the 101st than it is working with an ODA or with a SEAL platoon or SEAL team, anything like that. So, you know, I was in a position to learn a lot of different languages, see a lot of different things and see how other units and organizations and some very elite people, how they operated. We did a lot of good stuff, a lot of training and did a lot of drinking and a lot of bad decision-making in the process and had kids, you know, at a young age, had my son Kyle when I was 24, June 4th, 2001. And then you remember what happened a couple months after that, 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, being a close air support guy, we were super busy. That's, basically 9/11 was what started bringing a lot of attention to the Air Force side of, special tactics, special warfare, I think was what they're called now, special warfare. The name changes and I'm retired. And that's not who I am. That's a part of my story. Mm-hmm. And that prepared me, honestly, and Jeremy Locke and, you know, the team, the guys, the core of air recovery, you know, our training in the military, it's amazing how easy it is to work in the humanitarian space, responding to disasters and, you know, all over the planet and doing some of these things and helping combat human trafficking because you're able to see things differently. You know, we play chess. We're thinking three dimensions mm-hmm. when a lot of people are, they're not thinking that third step ahead. And the units that I work with before, and I say this all the time, I would prefer to work with an ODA if I could choose who I would deploy with because they're amazing problem solvers. They're the best planners. And you know, from your experience, piss poor planning equals a piss poor plan. A lot of these movies are because there was really bad plans and then Hollywood makes it look super sexy and cool. And you're like, that's not really how that happened, but okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, it's again, Green Berets are amazing trainers, they're amazing operators, and they're some of the best planners on the planet. I would go into any situation with a well-trained Green Beret. I trust.
You mentioned ODA. Tell our listeners what that is.
ODA is an Operational Detachment Alpha, a Special Forces A-team, which I had the luxury of, you know, working with those guys a little bit. So it was very fun. And, you know, being stationed at Campbell, you're right there. 5th Special Forces Group is there. The 160th is there. And it's kind of funny because Jenna's ex was, you know, in the 160th. Interesting. Funny. It's funny that I listened to the podcast, you know, earlier, but yeah, like our story is pretty funny. And it's one of those kind of like, you can't control what happens. All you can control is how you react to what happens. And when our right. worlds collided, we fell, you know, head over heels in love. And, we've not looked back and, we want to try to be, you know, role models for other couples and we want to just be impactful. And I just love her to death. I love you, baby.
Yeah. Then you are more than welcome to say that all day long here. I thank the world of you guys. When you're talking about the tactical, so you mentioned ACP, Tactical Air Control Party, and yep. I got this out of an article. I had to look it up to see what it was. It's an officer directs lethal and non-lethal joint firepower anywhere, anytime that the battle calls for it. Now that's, so you got to be right up front in the action, right? You got to be out there where you can.
Yeah.
Are you pointing a laser?
Sometimes, yeah. Oddly enough, like that, like the headset that you sent me, you know, I would have dual communications. So I would have maybe, you know, however I had it set up with my push to talk. So in my left ear, I might be hearing you know, a bunch of Army guys or a bunch of Marines. And in this year, I might be hearing 10 to 15 different aircraft from, you know, helicopters, rotary wings, sometimes from 1,000 feet above ground level up to 30,000 feet. And I'm deconflicting all of any JTAC. There's a reason why we had such a high operational tempo. And why I said earlier that I wouldn't know when I would be back in Afghanistan, or if I was in Iraq, I knew I'd be in Afghanistan, you know, blah, 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 before I even got home, to be home for 6 months to get ready to go again. 6 months on, 6 months off, 6 months on, 6 months off. It was years like that. We digressed, though.
That's okay.
So, we had, you know, communications, and you've got to see. So to bring in precision effects, right? Because you don't request a munition, you request an effect. So if the ground commander is authorizing me as the JTAC, Joint Terminal Attack Controller, and we at the time had a special experience identifier. It's a DOD SEI 914. It's a special experience identifier that means you're qualified to call in close air support and close proximity to friendly forces, and we're experts at doing that stuff. You've got to be at a vantage point where you can have eyes on the target. So what that means is you're engaged in whatever those Green Berets are doing or those infantrymen are doing, and you're engaged in what's actually happening. But then also you've got the aerial view, as we like to call it with aerial recovery, you know, it's having the bigger view on things, with all the aircraft, all the sensors, and, you know, able to make an ODA with a JTAC. When Afghanistan first happened, the combat controllers and the soft TACPs that were in there doing that stuff were doing amazing work. And they were, talk about being a force multiplier, and Green Berets are, that's what they, you know, they're great at training and, you know, grooming force multipliers in other countries and stuff like that. The skill set's pretty unique in multitasking and always having to navigate it differently and, you know, speaking different languages. A lot of training, a lot of deployments. I got married when I was 3, shortly after, got pregnant with Kyle, my oldest, and Kyle, he received an autism diagnosis when we were in Alaska. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but just kept the operational tempo up. 9/11 happens 3 months after Kyle's born, and you know what that meant. We were gone a lot, all the time, and when we were home, we were training. Got pregnant with Caitlin, my daughter, who just turned 21. I just kept the operational tempo up, and you had spoke about it earlier. You know, what had disintegrated the marriage was you grow up heart. You know, I mean, at that point I was gone more than I was home. You know, you got to understand too, the 6 months we were home there for a while, we were home for 6 months, gone for at least 6 months. Right. The 6 months that you're home, we would get home and we would turn in some sensitive items and do some out processing, maybe do an intel out brief. And then they'd give us, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks off work, stay in the local area. Decompress, reintegrate with your family. That 15th day or whatever it was, when you'd come back in, you would basically go straight back in. You'd go into deployment preparation. So the 6 months that I was home, I would train. I'd go out to Arizona, would go to Southern California. We traveled to these close air support bombing ranges all over the country. You know, fighter and bomber aircraft and rotary wing attack helicopters would come in. We'd practice doing close air support, you know, train, sweat, bleed, and, you know, training here in, you know, when you're CONUS, when you're in the United States and garrison, so that when it matters, you're ready to go. You're ready to do that at the, you know, the highest level of readiness that you can be, because they're counting on the guy to your left and right, just like they're counting on you. And, you know, they're counting on the JTAC to be that belly button to help sometimes get out of some pretty gnarly situations.
It's, you know, you're literally holding American service personnel and allied personnel, their lives in your hand. It, being a JTAC officer brings multitasking to a whole new level. I don't know. It's got to take a lot of practice to master that. Multiple radios, one in one ear and the other in the other ear. And you got ground forces, you got air forces up. I can't imagine going through that. The stress level must be through the ceiling.
Yeah. Looking back, I mean, it was stressful. You miss it. You know, you look at some of the, you know, your training and some of the stuff you did in the DEA, like some of the crummier situations actually are like some of the more fun and your best memories and like fun stories.
Ooh, yeah.
Some of the controlled, the chaos that you controlled and brought order to or whatnot. Yeah.
Or definitely that's what we'll be survived. Thinking about,
you know? Yeah.
It gets crazy.
Here's the story. I wanted to clarify. I was not an officer. I was enlisted. There are officers in the TACV career field. I did actually help develop that career field there for a little bit with a couple of TDYs. But I was an enlisted guy.
Gotcha. I didn't mean to insult you like that.
Oh, no, it's okay. I was pretty insulted. No, I'm kidding.
Well, you know, you were talking about having that special training where you could call in a close airstrike. That's we had Jason Redmond on here. You met Jason. You may have already known Jason at the Military Appreciation Weekend, yeah. But I read his book and then had him on the show here, and that's they had to do that. I mean, they were and the pilots were just saying no, and then they finally went to somebody that had your qualification. To get the authorization, I guess you have to issue a special code when you authorize it or whatever, and it relieves them of any responsibility.
Yeah. So there, if you're calling in, I want to say this the right way. If you're calling in and you're requesting a weapon effect, and it's really, really close to a friendly forces, there's a high probability of there being some fratricide, of there being mm-hmm. some weapons effects that degrades your ability to operate afterward. And some of our training, we literally knew how close we could be to a bomb in meters. If we were laying down, if we were like, hey, I need you to hug dirt now and get down the prone and you're in helmet and you're covering up and just get as low as you can. We knew like, oh, I can be about 2 football fields away from that bomb. And there's a, 1% chance that we'll be degraded and not be able to, continue the mission for a couple minutes.
That's crazy. That's why they call it Danger Close.
Yeah. There's actually a book called Danger Close. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a movie out also.
Yeah. I didn't watch that one. I'm sure it's probably based loosely on the same thing, but yeah, a lot of those guys are my friends in that book.
So I read this about you. Between 2002 and 2012, you did 7 deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq, and those are 6-month deployments, right?
Yeah. I had one deployment that was a year. It was like towards the end of the marriage when things just weren't good and stuff. I kind of volunteered, took one for the team and took one so that another guy would not have to come, and be away from his family for 6 months in that leadership position. But, yeah, it was a lot of deployments.
And so we're certainly not going to say anything disparaging about your first wife. It's until you walk in somebody's shoes, don't try to judge them. That's the way I look at it. But you're coming home, and it's very similar to Jenna's first marriage. You're coming home, you're there, but you're really not there. You're still in Afghanistan or Iraq. You're preparing to go back. Yeah, I know where your focus is. I'm the same way. If I've got something coming up, I hear about it at home, but we just celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary last week, so I think this marriage is probably going to last a while. Although Connie likes to point out that if she'd killed me a long time ago, she'd have got out in 20 years. She'd have been free for the last 20 years. I don't know what that says about me. But now, how was your first wife handling this? Were you catching a lot of grief from her? And I'm going to say rightfully so, because I love her unsung heroes.
Yes. And I want to speak to that too, because I want to speak to that, make sure we don't skip over that. So, you get used to it. You get used to what kind of a rhythm, she didn't work. She just stayed at home. We were very fortunate in that we received some extra pays and stuff. It wasn't like thousands and thousands of dollars, but you jump out of planes, you get paid a little bit more. We got special duty pays and we got pretty big reenlistment bonus, very, pretty big ones, to be honest. And, if you did that in a tax-free zone, your hundred plus, sometimes $1,000 bonus would not be taxed. Mm-hmm. She liked the reenlistment bonuses, obviously. Didn't really care for me being gone. So, but you kind of get used to like, it feels like almost at a point where if I was home too long there towards the end of it, where we were just basically like business partners and, raising the Griffith Kids LLC, that's literally all we were for probably the last 6 years of our marriage. And that's, I feel bad about that, but it happened. And, the children suffer, like you said, when you're talking with Jenna with split ups, and you don't divorce your kids. Sometimes you do things because you realize it's affecting your parenting, and you're going to be a better, healthier parent if you can get some healing and you can remove some toxic stuff. Because that's what happened, is I realized it was affecting my parenting. So it did take a toll on our marriage. You can't say it doesn't. That Jenna wrote Service and Soul because the military family has to digest and has to process and unpackage a lot of different nuances like the DEA family does that the Walmart family doesn't. So, and that's not to say that the Walmart family won't encounter some stressors and a crappy day at work, but a crappy day at work at 7-Eleven is different than a crappy day at work being a DEA agent or, being a humanitarian special operator or an active duty, joint term attack controller or an infantryman or what have you. So, we went through it. We were one of the families. Why Jenna wrote the book, because the families, they sit back there and it's not their job just to be waiting around. You know, we're the ones that are heralded. You know, there's promotion ceremonies at our units, the change of command, commanders talk, you know, this, that, and the other. And then they talk about, you know, the families, you know, of the people retiring for like 2 seconds, give them some roses maybe and a plaque. They just need support. The families need support. Like I said, too, it's a culture of drinking. As long as you don't get a DUI in the military, and you know, I became a functioning alcoholic, during my career, because you don't have that kind of operational tempo. You don't see those sorts of things. You don't go straight from, you know, chaos in Afghanistan or Iraq to, you know, a transatlantic flight, and then you come home and you're automatically super dad. Mm-hmm. And super son and super husband. No, we don't have an on-off switch. And when it was like the yo-yo effect, my name is a lot of guys, your identity when you're doing that is so in that, because you're in life or death situations every 6 months. And then when you're home for 6 months, you're training to go do that while you're so crappy to say, but you're almost like trying to find time to be a dad and be a husband.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And that's not right. And that, so that the families, they have to unpackage and deal with a dynamic that is just, you know, veterans and first responders. Let me say this, law enforcement officers, our medics, our firemen, you know, forestry, you know, firefighters, these guys do this every day. A law enforcement officer could get shot at by Americans on our own streets every day, potentially. And when I walk around here, I feel pretty safe. If I see a cop, I'm glad. Mm-hmm. You know, I taught my kids to respect law enforcement officers. They're your friends. You know why? Because, you know, if you're not breaking the law, you need help, call them. Yep. If you didn't have cops, try calling a crackhead, see if they'll come help you. they're not. But I hate all that stuff. But it definitely is a needed and a missing niche. And I'm just, you know, I talked about it. I wonder how many, if there would have been like a service and soul, or there was more of a focus on this in the DEA and in law enforcement and in the fire departments and in the military, if there was more of a focus on the families, if there would have been 30 years ago, you know how many marriages could have potentially been saved?
Yeah,
suicides potentially, you know, averted.
It was, well, I got into law enforcement starting in 1975, and it was when traumatic events happened, they were expected to suck it up and get back out on the street. You know, counseling was unheard of. And then I came on DEA in 87, and in 89, we got in a shooting, a little gun battle there in Hialeah, Florida, a suburb of Miami. And my partner was hit twice in the bedroom. We're fighting from a bedroom, shooting at a guy out in the hallway. And as the guy's making his escape, he shoots the informant right in the throat. So he died. Kevin got hit. My partner got hit twice in the right arm with 45 caliber slugs and kept his arm, believe it or not. But when that was over, you know, the DEA didn't come to me and tell me, hey, you need to go to counseling. You need to do this, do that. They're like, it's like, okay, you can take a couple of days and get your butt back in here. And
we trained you how to be resilient.
Yeah. And you know what? It didn't. I've been in a lot of shootings in my career in 38 years, but none of them ever bothered me except the one when my partner was shot. And I didn't go to counseling. And when a senior agent came to me one day, he's like, Murph, did you go to counseling? And I said, no, and I'm not going. He's like, get your butt in there. You got to do it. And of course I didn't. And that was in 89. I retired in 2013. Until the day I retired from DEA, I had still had dreams, not nightmares, but I still had dreams about Kevin shooting, just reliving it over in your mind. And they became less and less as the years went on. And then when I retired from DEA, I haven't had the dream since. Back in your situation, you're in an extremely high stress situation there as a combat controller, basically. And now you come home and you got the family pressure. So did you recognize that at the time as post-traumatic stress syndrome, or you just think, man, I can't wait to get back overseas. This is too much.
Couldn't wait to get home and drink. I couldn't wait to, you basically, we self-medicated, it's a culture. I'm not trying to bash anything. I'm just saying it's a culture of drinking. I mean, we would drink it. We would have a hail and farewell when we would, you know, hail in the new people in the unit, and we would say farewell to the brothers that we deployed with and did great things. And we'd hug and cry and say goodbye and stuff like that. And we'd drink. You'd go to an intel brief on Friday afternoon and talk about what parts of the world, where the focus was. And you'd leave and you'd be like, and you drink. Because you realize like how, you know, close a lot of places are to becoming just a dumpster fire. It's heavy drinking. And it's because as long as you can do your job, as long as you don't get a DUI, which I almost did. Yeah. Just don't get in trouble. Drink, but don't get caught.
Hey, players, this is the end of part one. As you know, part two comes out tomorrow on a Tuesday. In the meantime, on social media, go and check us out on X at Game of Crimes and on Facebook and Instagram at Game of Crimes Podcast. Also on Facebook, type in Game of Crimes fan page and join us for some more fun. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including all our episodes, the book list, which contains the books written by our guests, Game of Crimes merchandise, and a lot more. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.